While you're in meditation now, I'd like to read you a passage that will possibly be familiar to you. You've all seen it, but you may have forgotten it. It's from Joel. I have never left you. I have never been separate or apart from you. I have walked with you every step of the way, awaiting your recognition. Long have I awaited you. Long have I awaited your awakening. Long have I awaited your return. Long have I awaited your recognition. Look within and find me. For I am within you. I am the very fabric, the very source of your life. So you know at this point that the I that is speaking is not Joel, it is I, the I of your being, speaking through what appears to be Joel, just as the I spoke through Jesus in what appeared to be Jesus, but it was always the I of everyone who spoke to Jesus but did not recognize I. This I within you is the real writer of the Bible. It is your real teacher. It is the real self. Now let's continue with this meditation, listening to the words of I through Joel, for they are the words of I in the midst of you. The headaches you have known, the problems you have suffered, all these have been only because of this sense of separation, which has kept your gaze on the outer realm instead of compelling you to turn within where I am to be found. I am to be found within your consciousness, within your awareness. I am to be found in quietness, in stillness, in confidence. And that word confidence means in confidence that I am present as your being, that I am the Spirit of God within you. That confidence that I, the Spirit of God within you, am present where you are at all times. That's the meaning of the word confidence used here. A confidence that can never leave you if you accept omnipresence of the Spirit that is I. Now he's building us into something. Be not afraid. Be not afraid. It is I. I, the I that is speaking to you, is the I of that army that is marching against you. Now, what turned me to this meditation of Joel's was the news yesterday about the bombings in the banks, the time bombs. And I'm quite sure that the world, our little USA at least, was very frightened about the possibilities. Look back at this line now and see if you saw it that way yesterday. The eye of that army that is marching against you is the eye that is speaking to you. You see that there are no enemies when you are in the eye, what appears to be an enemy or a threat or in any way an act of violence is seen through the spiritual consciousness as non-existence. For only I am there. Fear not, it is I. Now, if I am there, do you think something else is there? Do you see that only I am there? That omnipresence is all that can be there? That I in the midst of you means that I am where you are and only I am. Now we're learning to accept that omnipresence doesn't have room for another self, another presence, another being. When we learn that God is your being, when we learned we were incorporeal being, that didn't leave a physical being standing there. That was the dissolution of the belief in a corporeal being. You don't have one foot in heaven and one foot on earth. You don't have one foot in reality and one foot in unreality, one foot in spirit and one foot in matter. I, in the midst of you, is identity. And therefore the me, which still lives in a corporeal sense, is not identity, and we're learning is not there. I who speak am the identity of the army that marches against you, and therefore, because I am not an army marching against you, the army marching against you is sense misperception. In corporeal senses, we see the army marching. In spiritual awareness, we recognize only I am there. It is I, the eye of the being of your friends and of your foes. I dwell in you and I dwell in them. As I dwell in you, so do I dwell in them, and so do I dwell in all. In meeting friend, in meeting foe, you are meeting me. That means you're not meeting a friend. You're not meeting a foe, you're meeting me. Every form is a concept entertained about the invisible me, the I of being. There will come a time when this will be a normal consciousness among us. Recognize me in the midst of you. Then recognize me in the midst of your friends. And recognize me in the midst of your foes. In other words, all human beings represent our good and bad human judgments, but only the omnipresent spirit, the I, stands before you. Recognize that there is but one divine selfhood, one Father of all, and you will soon see that the only enemies you ever had consisted of your own belief in a selfhood separate and apart from me. No matter what you see, there is no selfhood separate and apart from the divine self. And therefore, the friendly and unfriendly, the material, being a selfhood that is not the spirit, it is not apart from God, it simply is non-existent. You are forming a concept about the invisible spirit. You are making the incorporeal into a graven image in your mind called a corporeal self, calling it enemy or friend. It isn't there. You're looking at a picture in your sense mind. It is presenting to you a picture in its sense mind. And the world around you represents the pictures we entertain, each of us, in our sense mind. This hypnotism is the only sin. There is no evil. There is hypnotism. There is no disease. There is hypnotism. There is no famine, no poverty. There is hypnotism. There is a material sense interpreting spirit into lack and limitation. There is a material sense that does not know God aright. A material sense that cannot perceive divine spirit. And building our spiritual consciousness, losing our material consciousness, is the way we are told to bring the experience of heaven into our earth. There's just a bit more now on Joel's statement here. Even if you recognize me as your selfhood, you may still have thought of others as having some selfhood apart from me, but I am your selfhood. I am the selfhood of all those others. I am your staff of life. I am your wisdom, present tense. I am your bread, your meat, your wine, and your water. But I am these to all men. I am this in the midst of your friends and your loved ones, and I am this in the midst of your foes. Recognize me in the midst of all, and then you will discover that I am in all. And I greet you through all. I greet you through those you thought were your friends. I greet you through those you thought were your enemies. For you can never be greeted by any other than I, because I am infinite. I am infinite omnipresence. I am omnipotent omnipresence. I am the presence that stands within you, before you, beside you, behind you. I am that presence, and therefore be not afraid. It is I. It is I. I am not in the whirlwind. Therefore recognize that there is no power in a whirlwind. The only power there is in I. That I that I am, which is the life of your being, the life of your friend's being, the life of your enemy's being. I am the life of all being. Now, for those of you who want to review that again, you'll find it on page 85, not of the book we're studying at the moment, but you'll find it on page 85 of The Mystical Eye. You'll also find on your tape, your eighth tape of The Mystical Eye, a discussion of this. And you'll be surprised how fresh it sounds, even though some weeks have gone by since we all studied it together. That's the chapter I Speaks in Mystical I. Oftentimes we go past these chapters, forgetting to return, because always there's new manna waiting for us. We have come to another level of consciousness, and that opens up things we hadn't noticed before. If for this past week you've been trying to practice incorporeality, you've had a difficult time. It doesn't come easy. It doesn't yield quickly. It's a challenge. But if you've been trying to do it by yourself, you've magnified your problem. The only way to come into incorporeality is to yield that self, that human sense of self, and let I take you into itself, to unself, in order to find self. Now, some of you may be latecomers to the message of the infinite way, and may be clinging to the idea that we're attempting to make your life very comfortable. I assure you, we are not. You may think that we want to make you into a very good human being who is happy and successful, and I assure you we are not. I can show you page after page in Scripture in which the Master specifically said to those whom he had spoken to once, "Oh, you've come for loaves and fishes, haven't you?" Specifically, he took the ground out underneath his disciples and made them walk in the Spirit, because a good and better sense of human life was not his purpose. Our function here is not to become happy, successful human beings. Our function is to become aware of our divinity, to seek first our divinity, the kingdom of God, the eye of being, which is omnipresent. And then, becoming in a measure aware of that eye, it is insufficient to say, "Oh, I is omnipresent. Spirit of God is everywhere." That's only a step. When you have been willing to accept and to live by the omnipresence of your spirit, you must accept that it is omnipotent, and all other powers are tempting you to deny that very spirit you are saying is omnipresent. Now, unless you are preparing yourself carefully, you will deny omnipresence all day long. And I found it very helpful to stand at a window, to look out. And up and down the street, you'll see a car coming and a person walking, things happening. And it's very important to you to do this, to look out consciously, innerly declaring, "That person there, walking on that street, is not there. My spirit is. That automobile coming down the street is not there. My spirit is. That freeway is not there. My spirit is." It is not enough to say that God is omnipresent. You've got to know that where God is, nothing else is. And if you've got a freeway that to you is accepted as a reality, you've denied that God is there. If you've got a person somewhere that you've accepted as a reality, you've denied that God is there. If you've got an automobile somewhere that you accept as a reality, you have denied that God is there. God is not an automobile. God is not a freeway. God is not a person. But God is all. And what are you looking at? You're looking at concepts, material concepts. Where are they? They're not out there. They're in your mind. They're in your five senses. And you cannot go further in the mystical consciousness until you're willing to sit down with this and dwell with it and either accept it or reject it. You cannot leave it as a moot question, something you don't come to grapple with. It's a strange notion, and you've got to wrestle with it. If you cannot accept it, you might as well forget the infinite way, because you're never going to get into it. And when you can accept it, you've got to cut all of the ties that bind you to the denial of that which you have accepted. Your spirit is the only spirit in the universe. And you've got to practice it every day. Every day you've got to be aware that you are the only spirit in the universe. There is no other. There isn't Johnny's spirit and Mary's spirit and Helen's spirit. There's your spirit. And that is the spirit of Johnny, Mary, and Helen. And Mary can be saying the same and it will be true of her. And John can be saying the same and it will be true of him. Because we're all talking of the spirit that I am. I am the only spirit. And the spirit that I am being everywhere, that is all that is there. I cannot practice living in that spirit until I have accepted that there is no other. Throughout space and time, beyond space and time, is your spirit. Cannot memorize it. You must dwell with it until something in you opens to admit this into consciousness. And then you will know that no matter what happens in the external world, whether it's safety or danger, it isn't happening. All that is there is your spirit. And that is the spirit of God. That is the starting consciousness in mysticism. That is the abiding consciousness in mysticism. And that is the consciousness in which the Spirit of God can appear to you as grace. Therefore, we do not rejoice too much in our successes any more than we take sorrow in our failures. We learn that all of our past was a sense of matter that we entertained, which happened only in our mind. We have no past. Neither do we have a future. We are living in eternity in spirit, as the one infinite spirit. Now, if your heart opens to this, then you can accept that God being the spirit of your being, the power of that spirit is always functioning everywhere. So that up and down this infinite universe, which is your spirit, the power of your spirit is functioning, self-maintaining. It is always maintaining its perfection. And it makes no difference what the senses bring forth. They can never push aside the power of the Spirit of God, which is your spirit everywhere. And therefore, you are walking in the consciousness of invisible perfection everywhere. Yes, this is the consciousness we are to attain. We cannot attain it without living in it and practicing it. You'll notice that it is not God's spirit alone you're talking about, it is your spirit. That is what has been missing. The belief that God's spirit is something I've got to attain. God's spirit is your spirit. God's spirit is I in the midst of you. And I in the midst of you am wherever God is. And so you're in the omnipresence of your spirit, which means the only spirit in the universe. It's the spirit where all the forms seem to be. It's the spirit where the rivers and the mountains seem to be, where the planets and the stars seem to be. Your spirit is there. Now, I am. And if tomorrow's paper reported a collision between two planets, it would be a double lie. Only your spirit is there, not planets. And secondly, your spirit is maintaining its perfection at all times. God is never moving aside. God is never absent. God is never disappearing. God is never stopping his function of being the perfect self. And that is your spirit. No matter what comes into the Sunday, Monday, Tuesday paper, if somebody tells you the world just blew up, there must be the consciousness that I will not be tempted into accepting that there is something in this universe beside my spirit, which is the one Spirit of God. Or that there is a power that can push that spirit aside. And therefore, that which I see and hear, however devastating it seems to the human senses, is an image in thought. Now, you're not asking the world to believe this. You're learning that to believe it, you must live with it first in many small ways until accumulation of evidence to you is such that you're able to accept it more wholeheartedly. Once you deny perfect power everywhere, you have denied your omnipresent spirit everywhere. And I wish to make that point very clear, that you cannot be declaring omnipresence in one place but not declaring omnipotence at the same time, because omnipresent spirit is omnipotent. You see, this means that whatever you see in the physical world is not there, whether it's good or bad. You cannot be omnipresent spirit and have a physical world too. This is the division that makes death inevitable. This is the division that makes disease and evil and error inevitable. There was a time when the Master felt he had enough disciples to send out to practice a measure of this. They went out two by two, 70 of them. He said, "I send you out as lambs among the wolves. You may have had the feeling that wherever you go, you're walking among those who are ignorant of this spiritual truth, while even you yourself are not able to demonstrate it to your own satisfaction." The disciples returned overjoyed. They had found new power within themselves. They did healings. But each one individually was capable of just so much. You and I today are capable of just so much. It isn't enough what you can do and what I can do. The uplifting of the world consciousness is what each of us is here to do. As you lift your consciousness to this realization that your spirit is everywhere now, and look out and will not accept what denies your omnipresent spirit, you are embracing the universe in truth. You are casting bread upon the waters. The miracle of your awareness of omnipresent spirit comes back to you as better humanhood, improved form, improved supply, improved health, the added things. But something beyond the added things has happened. Another measure of Christ has lifted the world consciousness. We're going to look at loaves and fishes. Well, we've probably studied it four or five times together. You've probably read it 10 more times yourself. We want to see it with new eyes today. We want to see it from the standpoint of the incorporeal universe, your omnipresent spirit. And as you listen to it, see if certain words to you contain a key. Listen very carefully, because it's quite amazing how new things begin to be significant that you never even knew were in the various episodes reported by the writers of the gospel. Suddenly a word you hadn't noticed before becomes very significant. Now, I'm telling you in advance that the multiplication of loaves and fishes reported here is different than anything you and I have said together. Possibly quite different than anything you may have heard. And so listen to his words, the words of I in the midst of you, as John reports these words. Listen from the spiritual selfhood. Listen from your omnipresent spirit, not from the level of the five-sense mind. Even, perhaps, learn how to hear these words within yourself instead of out there from a voice speaking external to you. See if you are not lifted to a place where the words say something new to you. We're going to pass by certain parts of John 5, which we will come back to sometime, and begin with John 6. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him, because they saw his miracles which he did on them that were diseased. And Jesus went up into a mountain. There he sat with his disciples. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. When Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come upon him, he saith unto Philip, Whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? And this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, saith unto him, There is a lad here, which hath 5 barley loaves, and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? And Jesus said, Make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that were set down, and likewise of the fishes, as much as they would. When they were filled, he said unto his disciples, Gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. Therefore they gathered them together, and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which remained over and above unto them that had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, This is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force, to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. It's very possible that the complete message is incorporated into these 15 verses. You will notice that Jesus never multiplied fishes and loaves by himself. Never to one disciple or another, but twice where there were multitudes, large multitudes, 5,000, 7,000. It has been assumed that this is a miracle. Let us look at it as a teaching instead for the moment and discover what we ought to do, to learn, to practice, in order to benefit by this teaching. Spiritually, the message is quite different than it has been interpreted to us by any of the churches that I know. Right at the beginning, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. There's a meaning in these two seas. It isn't accidental. You'll find it again, and you'll know then that the Sea of Galilee is the Word. Jesus went over the Word. The Sea of Galilee represents the living Word. It's a symbol, and it says here, it is the Sea of Tiberias. Why would they give a second name for the Sea of Galilee? To teach you that his doctrine, and that's the Sea of Tiberias, his doctrine comes from the living Word. The living Word is the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Tiberias, which is the Sea of Galilee, is the doctrine derived from the living Word. Now, this is for those who are listening with the inner ear. And so we know that the living Word is coming in a form of a doctrine now, a teaching, an esoteric teaching. If you were acquainted with the key words that are spoken in spirit, this would immediately alert you that an esoteric teaching is on the way. And remember, this is a physical appearance to men. They see a Sea of Galilee. They see a Jesus. They see. But the Sea of Galilee is the living Word made visible. Jesus is the living Christ made visible to the sense perception of men. The Sea of Galilee is not there. Jesus is not there. Only the Spirit of God is there. All that is there is your self, your invisible, everywhere, spiritual self. Your spirit is all that's there, and it is now appearing as Jesus crossing a sea with disciples, and multitudes will soon appear within your spirit. But it is all your spirit named I. Only one there knows that. His name is Christ Jesus. A great multitude followed him. And that means that as you become aware of I, the Spirit, the multitude that follows you, within you, your human thoughts begin to follow I instead of the carnal mind of the world. The I of you, traveling over the Sea of Galilee, the living Word begins to attract your thinking apparatus to a higher level. And the thoughts, the multitude of thoughts that swarm through you through the day, begin to be fed from the higher level. The multitude begins to follow him. The eye of you begins to attract, and the human, the animal in us begins to dissolve as we turn to this higher level of ourselves. We are traveling with him over the Sea of Galilee, opening to the Sea of Tiberias the Christ divine doctrine. Because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased. Ah, signs have begun to appear in our lives. We have become aware of another level. We may have seen somebody healed of this or that. And so because of these miracles, we're ready to turn to this higher level and give it an ear. We're turning away from the errors of the world. Jesus went up into a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now you remember the Sermon on the Mount? He went up into a mountain. Now this really is a permanent state of consciousness, the Christ consciousness, and in the Oriental imagery it is called going up into a mountain. You can be sure that he was in this consciousness. The higher consciousness, which lives in the invisible kingdom of heaven on earth. The multitudes that will appear as people are going to walk into this consciousness and be lifted into it. They're going to be fed a different kind of bread. And later, the bread that does appear will be the result of the spiritual feeding that is about to take place. It was Passover time. A feast of the Jews was nigh. Now let's connect this up with the Christ teaching of the real Passover. They were on their way to Jerusalem. Many stopped off. Why? Well, he had a reputation now. They knew he healed things. But that wasn't all. There was Herod. And there were those among the Hebrews who, with Herod, were not about to countenance any usurpation of their power, of their privileges, of their status. And Herod had gotten away with a very strange thing. He'd been able to murder John the Baptist. To the enemies of Jesus, this gave a great deal of hope, you know. If they could get away with murdering John the Baptist, why not Jesus too? And to those who believed on him, the question was, what would he do about it? Would he show some sign of divine authority? Both sides were seeing Jesus the man where Christ, the Spirit of God, was. And the Spirit of God was not going to do anything at all about it. The Spirit of God was going to fulfill the real need they had. They were going to Jerusalem for a Passover. He was going to give them a Passover, a real one, with spiritual bread. He was going to feed them divine bread. That means he was going to teach them truth. Long before it was announced that they were hungry, the Spirit knew that they were spiritually hungry. And now the teaching began. When Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, Whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? Now Philip saw them as hungry people. You know in the next line that the Christ didn't see them as hungry people at all. He was trying to show us the level of Philip's consciousness. first said here, and this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. He was trying to show that his disciple, Philip, at this stage, did not know truth. When the master said, what should we do to feed these? What was Philip's reply? It was the same reply that mankind has today. We need money. Philip turned to money. He said in his mind, money is what we need to feed these people. He had two limitations. One is, he needed money. The second was, even if he had the money, which would be a huge amount, I don't know how much money it would take to feed 5,000 people, but let's say a couple of $100. Even if he had it, where would he go? They were on the desert. And so Philip's concept of supply was money and a place where they would sell what was needed. Now the master is teaching us there is a real Passover in which you pass over from that consciousness which needs money and matter to another consciousness which doesn't need money and doesn't need matter. And that's quite different than our world knows about today. And so Philip had failed. Philip had shown that he was in the normal human material consciousness. He didn't know what to do. All he could do was turn to matter. And you can see that if he had to rely on matter, it would fail him because he couldn't find any. So Philip had no solution. In the material consciousness, there is no solution for famine. While you're getting one country to give some food here, somebody goes and steals it, as we learned out by now, and the people get fed for a day or two, but there's a black market pretty soon, and all you're doing is shifting money into somebody's pocket while people continue to starve. No, there is no material solution, is what the master is showing. There was no human way to feed that multitude. And if you expand the teaching, because he wasn't just talking about feeding their stomachs, there is no human solution to the human problems. They're all makeshift and temporary. You can transplant a kidney today and it's ruptured tomorrow. You can transplant a heart. Within a year or two, you find out all you've done is prolong the agony of a victim. There are no human solutions to human problems. And the human mind insists that there are. In fact, the human mind only looks for human solutions. And here the master is teaching us, don't. Don't you look to your human sense of values, because in the first place, what you are doing is making a human judgment that a problem exists. Your human judgment is denying the presence of your everywhere spirit. Your human judgment is denying that God is there. Your human judgment, which does not see God or know God is there, then denies that God's power is there. And now you're knee-deep in the hypnotism of the world. God isn't there, the power of God isn't there. All there is this stark, naked fact that somebody put bombs in the banks, or somebody declared war on another country. The facts of the material mind are there, instantly judged by that material mind. What has happened? The carnal mind, universal, places before us its pictures, and then the carnal mind individualizes in us, looks out on its own pictures, and confirms them. And we say, yes, that's the condition. But it isn't. It's only a condition existing in the universal carnal mind, which personalizes itself as the five-sense mind of every person. It's that closed-circuit TV. None of it is of God. None of it exists. All of it seems to be. And now closed-circuit TV presents itself as 5,000 people starving to death. Only one day there, you know. They didn't have to eat. Nobody would have died. That wasn't the issue at all, was it? But they had been learning from morning to after sundown. They had been learning truth. You know that they had already been fed. They had been fed spiritual bread. They were not hungry. Philip thought they ought to be. And the master said, what'll we do to feed them? And Philip fell for it. Oh, we have to feed them. He was unaware that all day long they had been fed spiritual food. That's how intelligent he was in the spiritual way. These 5,000 had traveled. Many on their way to Jerusalem had stopped off. Why? Because they were starved spiritually. They were hungry spiritually. And the master was teaching that's what they were starved for. Spiritual bread. And that's what they had received. Philip was blind. All he could say was, 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. He had a material concept of the whole thing, as the world has. Now comes, I think, Andrew. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said, there is a lad here. Now maybe you thought of that as a key word when I originally read this. It is. There is a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. Now Peter thought of supply outside, right? Money, availability. Now Andrew finds supply within the group. Ah, there is supply within us. 2 barley loaves, 5 barley loaves, 2 small fishes. But what are they among so many? Now, if you can, try to see that the 5 barley loaves and the 2 fishes represent mortality. We all start with that in this world, mortality. But we're going to do something with those 5 loaves and fishes and 2 fishes, with this mortality. We're going to transform our mortality. You see, you're back to the water and the wine. Andrew is more advanced than Peter and Philip. Andrew recognizes there's a quality within us that can be transformed into something else. And the lad means, it should be clear now, that the lad means in our undeveloped state, in the young, not yet mature spiritually. A lad has. In our sense state, we have 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes. In the sense state, which has not yet matured into spiritual awareness, that's all we have. Fine. Now we know where the disciples stand. Make them sit down. This was after a complete day of teaching. Shadows of the sun. The sun had gone down. The shadows of early twilight were beginning to fall. Make them sit down. Now, nobody had brought up the subject of feeding them. The master himself. As a matter of fact, if you read Luke or Matthew or Mark, you'll discover that everybody thought they were going home. The disciples had even suggested, let's send them home now. Why did he wait so long before he said, make them sit down? Why did he wait so long before coming into this miracle of multiplying loaves and fishes? Why didn't he do it at the beginning so that they'd be ready for the food would be ready later when they were ready for it? Because you couldn't have multiplied loaves and fishes until they had received spiritual truth. That's why no person in this world has duplicated that. Not one. No one ever will. It is the group consciousness that was brought forth. Greater works shall ye do. If you believe on me, greater works shall ye do. That ye is the plural. Meaning, not one person here and one person there will do greater works at all. The world consciousness will be raised to do the greater works. The consciousness of the 5,000 lifted by the presence of the Spirit, which recognized itself as the self of the 5,000. See those 5,000, they're not there. My Spirit is there. And then that Spirit teaches each of the 5,000 until they are aware of their Spirit to some degree, until they are spiritually consciousness at the end of this teaching, until they have received the food in their soul. And this bread of life in their soul is what is going to externalize as loaves and fishes. The greater works that shall be done will be done when you and I, receiving the Spirit within ourselves, accepting it, living in it, being true to it, lift those in our households, in our own spiritual households, until this circle of Christ is built. And the circle of Christ, of those who are spiritually consciousness, then externalizes not as loaves and fishes, which is what happens here, but you're looking at the preview of heaven on earth, the preview of the end of the world as we know it. As the circle of Christ widens, as consciousness expands, it which showed forth there as loaves and fishes to feed a multitude, it isn't going to be limited to 5,000 people. It's going to expand into the world around us. And as it does, as your everywhere self becomes more known to you, more lived in, not only loaves and fishes, but the full spectrum of reality will appear in the visible world, transforming the so-called evil errors, appearances that never were here. And that collective consciousness of man lifted up will react exactly as the multitude did on this memorable day. The multiplication of loaves and fishes is a preview of the multiplication of the divine word everywhere, coming through the circle of Christ consciousness, transforming earth into heaven. Make no mistake about it, it is presented to us in this book to show us that it isn't your individual consciousness that's going to do the greater works. Or mine. Oh, we'll go out like the disciples, like the 70. We might even raise the dead here and there. You might do some great works. But the greater works will not be done by one enlightened individual. The greater works will be the circle of Christ consciousness bringing forth divinity everywhere. I think we could pause at this point. take a minute, silence, get our bearings.